The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a very special Heretics Hour program on this Monday, January 28, 2013. I am Carolyn Yeager, your host for the next 2 hours. 2 days from now, January 30th, will mark the 80th anniversary of Adolf Hitler and his NSDAP parties taking power in Germany. Taking power is how it's popularly worded, because when it comes to Hitler, they always want it to appear that he just grabbed it or stole it, not that it was given to him, which it was, and we all know that it was. This was the date, though, of his taking the oath of office as Chancellor of Germany. It was January 30th, 1933. In Germany, this anniversary is not on the official calendar, but current Chancellor Angela Merkel gave a public address on Saturday, the day before the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, saying that Germany has a responsibility to prevent such a dark chapter, such as the Nazi era is what she meant, from ever repeating itself. It must be made clear to generation after generation, she continued, and we must say with courage, and the courage to stand up for one's beliefs, every single person can contribute to ensuring that racism and anti-Semitism have no chance. This is the sworn duty of the current governments of formerly white countries, to make sure that anti-Semitism and racism have no chance. Our younger people and our young people today have no memory of being all or nearly all white, and therefore easily tolerate the idea that it's an unrealizable and therefore unnecessary goal. That is one of our problems. Another is summed up in Merkel's repeating her words. As such, she went on to say, that's why it's even more important that we don't forget this dark chapter, that we always remember it, to make us immune so that we can never, never, so that it can never, never repeat itself. This is their work, you know, the main work of someone like her, to make sure nothing even slightly resembling the ideas of Hitler can gain even a tiny foothold. I believe this is really a concern of theirs, and that's why they work so hard at preventing it. And along with this, this morning, I just read that the NPD, Germany's Nationalist Party, the one that Gunther Deckert once led, is being fined over 1 million euros. I think it was like 1.4 million euros for what is charged as accounting irregularities in their party finances. They are fighting it, of course, and German politicians have been trying to find a way to make the NPD illegal, and bankrupting it is one way to get rid of it. In this atmosphere, in 2013, I'm thrilled to have in my possession something I've wanted for some time, ever since I first read that there was such a speech, and that is Adolf Hitler's speech with the title of Why We Are Anti-Semites, given on Friday, August 15th, 1920, at the Hofbrauhaus Beer Hall in Munich. Now, as a beer hall, they're called beer halls, but they weren't like some rough and tumble cellars. They were pretty nice places. People went there and drank and ate and socialized and so on. They had various rooms in these big ones, and this speech was given in what's called the Great Hall. But anyway, it came to me, the speech, thanks to my very wonderful friend and generous correspondent, Hasso Kastorp. Boy, am I glad he made contact with me after a couple of years' absence. We used to communicate some, and we actually had some argument going on, and I haven't heard from him for a couple of years, and now he reappeared, and very friendly, and well, with a few new ideas, and he turns out he knows several languages. He lives in Europe. He actually lives in Denmark. I don't think he minds me saying that. He's not a Dane, though, but he's European. And he is quite the translator, because, and he knows several languages, maybe four or five, and he can translate all of them from one to the boy. It's just great, you know, and he's fast, too. So, you know, I want to give him the credit he deserves, but I also hate to make him known to other people too much who would be asking him to do the same for them, because he's been a great asset for me. So to finish with the introduction, where was Adolf Hitler in his career when he made this speech? By early 1920, the DAP, or the, you know, the German Workers' Party, had over 500 members, and I think it was that. It's kind of hard to tell from what they're saying. But and Hitler was named as its head of propaganda. His actions began to transform the party. On February 20th, the party added National Socialist to its name and became the NSDAP. 4 days later, Drexler, Feder, and Hitler announced the party's 25-point program. Throughout 1920, Hitler began to lecture at Munich's beer halls, particularly the Hofbrauhaus, Sternecker Brau, and Burger Braukeller. By this time, the police were already monitoring the speeches, and police records reveal that Hitler delivered lectures with titles such as Political Phenomenon and Jews and the Treaty of Versailles. Couldn't tell whether that's one speech or two. It says Jews and the Treaty of Versailles. At the end of the year, party membership was recorded at 2,000. So he was growing the party. And in August, which is when this speech was made, Hitler also organized a group of security men under the guise of a gymnastics and sports division of the party. I thought that was so clever and so funny that they came up with the idea of a gymnastics and sports division for the men who were willing to be more physically active. And what they were supposed to do, the group was named first the Ordnertruppen, order troops, for the purpose of keeping order at Nazi meetings and to suppress those who disrupted the meetings. And when you listen to this speech, you will understand why that was necessary. And by the way, a couple of people have already asked me if I will post this on the internet. Well, sure, I do plan to do that, and probably will be able to do it tomorrow on my website. So don't fear, you will have a written version of it. So now I'm going to start reading because it's pretty long and I do want to get through it. I already gave you the particulars. National Socialist German Workers' Party public meeting in the Great Hall of the Hofbrauhaus. Oh, there's one more thing I should say, and I have it right here. Let's see. This was found. Somebody's already written to me, said, oh, this sounds fishy. You know, how do we know this is the real thing? You know, so on. Well, Hasso found this in the German, I won't try to say that, but it is, I think it's translated as Quarterly Yearbook or Yearbooks for Contemporary History of October 1968. Vierteljahrshefte for Zeitgeschichte. This is where it was found amongst a bunch of other stuff. And I think when you hear it, you will recognize that it is it's the real thing. It's not some kind of a forgery. Well, who knows about anything, you know. People can do a pretty good job of it. But anyway, we'll take it, and I'm taking it as it is. So he starts out, "My dear countrymen and women, we are quite used to being generally referred to as monsters. And we are considered particularly monstrous because in a question that certain gentlemen in Germany are nervous about, we are marching at the head, namely in the question of the opposition to the Jews. Our people understand many things, but this one problem nobody wants to understand. And in particular because, as a worker explained, what connection is there at all between the workers and the Jewish problem when in reality most of the people have no idea what this problem means? Most people let themselves be guided by feelings and say," this is Hitler saying that, "and say, I have seen good and bad people among them just like among ourselves. He goes on, very few have learned to view the problem free of emotion in its clean form. I will at once begin with the word work. What does it mean, work? Work is an activity performed not of one's free will, but for the sake of one's fellow men. If there is a difference between man and animals, so it is particularly regarding work, which does not originate in an instinct, but comes from an understanding of a necessity. Hardly any revolution has so deep an effect as the slow one which gradually transformed the lazy man of primeval time into the man who works. You know, it is true that if you read enough anthropology, that back in the the primitive man living in the southern climes, developing in warmer climate, really didn't do much. It was really, so when he says lazy man, he knew what he was talking about. So the little bit of reading that I've done, I was struck by the fact that they didn't have anything to do. They didn't work. They just laid around and then they found food to eat. And if they didn't have natural enemies around them, and a lot of them didn't. Okay, enough of that. Going back to the speech. Talking of work, we can assume that this activity followed these three phases. First, it was an effect of a simple instinct of self-preservation, which we also see in animals. Later, it developed into the second form of work, the one from pure egoism. Also, this form became gradually replaced by the third, work out of ethical sense of duty, where an individual does not work because he is forced to it. We see it at every turn. Millions of people work without being constantly forced to it. Thousands of intellectuals are sometimes bound to their studies for whole nights on end, day after day, although they may not do it for material gains. That's all of us. The hundreds of thousands of German workers after end of work tend their gardens. And generally, we see today that millions of people cannot imagine living without some sort of occupation. When I said that this process represents a slow, but perhaps also the greatest of all revolutions in human history, then one must assume that also this revolution had to have a cause, and this cause was the greatest goddess of this earth, the one who is able to whip men to the uttermost, the goddess of hardship. We can see this hardship in early prehistory, above all in the northern part of the world, in those enormous ice deserts where only the meagerest existence was possible. Here men were forced to fight for their existence, for things which were, in the smiling south, available without work and in abundance. In those times, man made perhaps his first groundbreaking discovery. In those cold stretches, man was forced to find a substitute of the only gift of heavens which makes life possible, the sun. And the man who produced the first artificial sparks later appeared to humanity as a god, Prometheus, the firebringer. North forced men to further activity, production of clothes, building of abodes. First it was simple caves, later huts and houses. In short, he created a principle, the principle of work. Life would not have been possible without it. Although work still was simple, it had already to be planned beforehand, and each individual knew that if he has not done his part, he would die of hunger in the coming winter. At the same time, another development followed. The terrible hardship became a means for breeding of a race. Who was weak or sickly, he could not survive the terrible winter period and died prematurely. And what remained was a race of strong and healthy giants. Yet another trait of this race was born. Where man is externally muzzled, where his radius of action is limited, he begins to develop internally. Externally limited, internally he becomes unlimited. The more man, due to external forces, must depend on himself, the deeper internal life he develops, and the more he turns inward. These three achievements, the recognized principle of work as a duty, the necessity not only out of egoism, but for preservation of the whole group of people, a small clan. Second, the necessity of bodily health, and thereby also of normal mental health. And third, the deep spiritual life, All these gave the northern races the ability to go to the world and build states. If this power could not find its full expression in the high north, it became apparent when the ice shackles fell and man turned south to the happier, freer nature. We know that all these northern peoples had one symbol in common, the symbol of sun, or it should be the sun. They created cults of light, and they've created the symbols of the tools for making fire, the drill and the cross. You will find this cross as a Hakenkreuz, as far as India and Japan, carved in the temple pillars. It is the swastika, which was once a sign of established communities of Aryan or Aryan culture. Those races, called today Aryans, created all the great cultures of the ancient world. Think of that. He's saying that. We know that Egypt was brought upon its high cultural level by Aryan immigrants. Similarly, Persia and Greece. The immigrants were blonde, blue-eyed Aryans. And we know that outside of these Aryan states, no civilized states have been founded. There emerged mixed races between the black, dark-eyed, and dark-colored southern races and the immigrants, but they failed to create any large creative culture states. Why is it that only Aryans possessed the ability to create states? It was due almost exclusively to their attitude to work. Those races which, as the first, stopped seeing work as the result of coercion and saw it rather as a necessity, born out of hundreds of thousands of years of hardship, had to become superior to other people. And besides, it was work that made people come together and divide the work among them. We know that the moment the individual worked to sustain oneself turned into work within communities, the community tended to assign a particular work to those particularly talented, and with increasing division of work, it became necessary with still greater joining together into still bigger groups. So it is work which created kinships at first, later tribes, and still later led to the creation of states. If we see as the first prerequisite for creating states the conception of work as social duty, so the second necessary ingredient is racial health and purity. And nothing helped the northern conquerors more against the lazy and rotten southern races than the refined strength of their race. States would remain an empty vessel if not decorated through that which we normally call culture. If we removed everything and kept just railways, ships, etc., if we removed everything we consider art and sciences, such a state would in reality become empty, and we would understand the creative power of the northern tribes. The moment their great inborn imagination could act in great free areas, it created everywhere immortal works. We see this process repeated continuously, even in the smallest scale. Similarly, we know that great minds are often born at the bottom of society, unable to develop there. But given an opportunity, they begin to grow and become leaders in arts, sciences, and also in politics. I wonder, aside here, if he was thinking of himself when he said that. We know today that there are extensive interrelations between the state, nation, culture, art, and work, and it would be madness to think that any of them could exist independently of the others. Let us take art, considered as an international domain, and we shall see that it is unconditionally dependent on the state. Art blossomed in those areas where the political development made it possible. The art of Greece reached its highest level when the young state had triumphed over invading Persian armies. Construction of the Acropolis began at that time. Rome became the city of art after the end of the Punic Wars, and Germany built her cathedrals, like in Worms, Speyer, and Limburg, Speyer spell, S-P-E-Y-E-R, when the German Empire under Salians had achieved their greatest triumph. We can follow this connection to our time. We know that art, for example, the beauty of German towns, always depended on political development of these towns. that it was political considerations which moved Napoleon III to regulating of the boulevards and Frederick the Great to establishing Unter den Linden, the great boulevard in Berlin. Similarly, in Munich, where it was obvious that the city could not become an industrial center, so art was chosen to elevate the rank of the city, which now everyone who wants to get to know Germany must visit. Similar were the origins of today's Wien, which is Vienna. Similar was the case with other arts. The moment the small, powerless statelets began to unite into one state, also one German art, proud of itself, began to grow. The works of Richard Wagner appeared in the period when shame and powerlessness were replaced by a unified Great German Reich. And so, not just art is dependent on the state, on the politics of the state. The same is the case with work itself, because only a sound state is in the position to give the opportunity of working to its citizens and let them use their talents. The opposite is the case with the race in relation to everything else. A state with a rotten, sick, and unsound race will never produce great works of art or make great politics, or at least wallow in abundance. Each of these factors depends on the others, and only when all of them complement each other can we say there's harmony in the state the way we Germanics understand it. Now we have to ask ourselves the question, how about the Jew as a state builder? Does the Jew possess the power to create a state? First, we must examine his attitude to work, find out how he perceives the principle of work. And excuse me if I now take a book called the Bible. I am not claiming that all its contents are necessarily true, as we know that Jewry was very liberal in writing it. One thing, however, is certain. It has not been written by an anti-Semite. This brings forth laughter from the crowd. It is very important because no anti-Semite would have been able to write a more terrible indictment against the Jewish race than the Bible, the Old Testament. Let us take a look at a sentence. Quote, "By the sweat of thy brow shalt thou eat bread," unquote. And it says that it was to be a punishment for the fall of man. Ladies and gentlemen, already here we see that the whole world lies between us. We could never conceive of work as a punishment. Otherwise, we would all have been convicts. We do not want to conceive of work as punishment. I must confess, I would not have been able to exist without work, and hundreds of thousands and millions would have been able to withstand perhaps 3 or 5 days, maybe even 10, but not 90 or 100 days without any activity. If paradise really existed, the land of plenty, then our people would have been unhappy in it. And now the audience calls out, "Hear, hear!" We Germans seek constantly a possibility to do something. And if we cannot find anything, at least from time to time, we hit one another in the face. That brings forth laughter. We are unable to bear absolute rest. Thus we see already here a big difference. Because a Jew has written this, true or not, it's unimportant because it still reflects the opinion which Jewry has about work. For them, work is not an obvious ethical duty, but at most a means to sustenance. In our eyes, this is not work because in this case, any activity serving self-preservation without regard to fellow men might be called work. And we know that this work in the past consisted of plundering of caravans, and today in planned plundering of indebted farmers, industrialists, and workers. The form has changed, but the principle is the same. We do not call it work, but robbery. Now the people in the place say, "Hear, hear!" When already such a basic notion separates us, here comes another. I have already explained that in the long period in the North, the races became purified. This means that all the inferior and weak gradually died out, and only the soundest remained. Also, here the Jew differs from us because he has not become purified, but instead practiced inbreeding. He multiplied greatly, but only in narrow circles and without selection. And therefore, we see a generation which is plagued by defects caused by inbreeding. Finally, the Jew does not possess the third factor, the inner spiritual life. I do not need to explain here what a Jew generally looks like. You all know him. There's laughter. You know his constant restlessness that never gives him a possibility to concentrate and have a spiritual experience. In the most solemn moments, he flickers his eyes, and one can see that even during the most beautiful opera, he is calculating dividends. This brings forth laughter. The Jew has never had his own art. Hear, hear, they say. His own temple has been built by foreign builders. The first was the Assyrians, and for the building of the second, the Roman artists. He has not left anything which might be called art. No buildings, nothing. In music, we know that he is only able to skillfully copy the other's art. We shall not conceal that today he has many famous conductors whose fame he can thank the well-organized Jewish press for. More laughter. When a nation does not possess these three traits, it is not able to create states. And that is true because throughout centuries, the Jew was always a nomad. A nomad. He has never had what we might call a state. It's a mistake which is spreading widely today to say that Jerusalem was a capital of a Jewish state, of a Jewish nation. On the one side, there was always a great chasm between the tribes of Judah and Caleb and the northern Israeli tribes, and only David, for the first time, succeeded in gradually bridging the chasm through the unitary cult of Yahweh. We know precisely that this cult has at a very late time chosen for itself Jerusalem as its sole seat. Only from that moment have the Jewish people gotten a center, like Berlin or New York or Warsaw today. Hear, hear, says the crowd. This was a town in which the Jew gradually, thanks to his talents and traits, achieved predominance, partly through the force of arms, partly through the power of trombones. I'm not sure what that means. Besides, the Jew already in those times lived as a parasite in the body of other peoples, and it had to be so. Because a people which does not want to work, the often hard work of building and maintaining a state, to work in mines, factories, in construction, all this was unpleasant to the Hebrew. Such a people will never establish a state, but prefers to live in some other state, where others work, and he acts as an intermediary in business, a dealer in the best case, or in a good German, a robber, a nomad who undertakes robbing raids, just like in ancient times. Now the crowd is very lively. They say, bravo, and clap their hands. They like that. And so we can now understand why the whole Zionist state and its establishing is nothing but a comedy. Yeah, and it should be probably, and its establishment is nothing but a comedy, the Zionist state. Herr Chief Rabbi has now said in Jerusalem, establishment of this state is not the most important. It is, I should read it like Hadding, like so you'd know it's the rabbi, but it is far from certain that it will at all be possible. However, it is necessary that Jewry has this city as its spiritual headquarters, because Jewry, materially, and in fact, are the masters of several states, and we control them financially, economically, and politically. Wow, this was all said by the rabbi. Let me repeat that. Establishment, he's in Jerusalem, establishment of this state is not the most important. It is far from certain if it will at all be possible. However, it is necessary that Jewry has this city as its spiritual headquarters, because Jewry, materially and in fact, are the masters of several states. We control them financially, economically, and politically. And so the Zionist state is going to be a harmless corn of sand in the eye. Efforts are made to explain, well, that's what he is saying, that according to them, you know, their Zionist state won't be harmful to anybody else. Just be a little tiny thing. Efforts are made to explain that so and so many Jews have been found that want to go there as farmers, workers, even soldiers. Now there's laughter from the listeners. If these people really have this urge in themselves, Germany today needs these ideal men as turf cutters and coal miners. They could take part in building our water power plants, our lakes, etc. But it does not occur to them. The whole Zionist state will be nothing else than the perfect high school for their international criminals. And from there, they will be directed. And every Jew will, of course, have immunity as a citizen of the Palestinian state. More laughter. And he will, of course, keep our citizenship. But when caught red-handed, he will not be a German Jew any longer, but a citizen of Palestine. Laughter from the crowd. One can almost say that the Jew cannot help it, because everything stems from his race. He cannot do anything about it, and besides, it doesn't matter whether he is good or bad, for he must act according to the laws of his race, just like do members of our people. A Jew is everywhere a Jew. Consciously or unconsciously, he resolutely represents the interests of his race. Let me get a little drink of water. Thus we can see the two great differences between races. Arianism means ethical perception of work, and that which we today so often hear, socialism, community spirit, common good before own good. Jewry means egoistic attitude to work, and thereby mammonism and materialism, the opposite to socialism. Hear, hear, say the people. And due to these traits, which he cannot overstep them as they are in his blood, and as he himself admits, in these traits alone lays the necessity for the Jew to behave unconditionally as a destroyer of states. He cannot do otherwise, whether he wants it or not, and thereby he is unable to create his own state because it requires a lot of social sense. He is thereby only able to live as a parasite in the states of others. He lives as a race amongst other races, in a state within other states. And we can see very precisely that when a race does not possess certain traits, which must be hereditary, it not only cannot create a state, but must act as a destroyer, no matter if a given individual is good or evil. So I kind of emphasize this because he's making it very clear that, as he sees it, it doesn't matter. It's not about Jews being good or evil, but that they have traits which they must act on, and they must act as a destroyer of other people's states. We can follow this fate of Jewry from the earliest prehistory. It is not important if there is truth in every word of the Bible. In general, it gives us at least an extract of the history of Jewry. We see how the Jews present themselves because the Jew wrote these words quite innocuously. It did not appear to him as outrageous when a race, through cunning and deceit, invaded and despoiled other races, was always finally expelled, and unoffended, sought to repeat the same elsewhere. They pimped and haggled even when it came to their ideals, always ready to offer even their own families. We know that not long ago a gentleman was staying here, Sigmund Frankl, who has just written that it is quite unjust to accuse Jews of materialistic spirit. One should only look at their sunny family life, he says. However, this intimate family life did not prevent grandfather Abraham in pimping off his own wife to the Pharaoh of Egypt in order to be able to do business. Laughter. As was the grandfather, so was the father, and so were the sons, who never neglected their business. And you can be sure that they are not neglecting the business even as we speak. Who among you was a soldier? He will remember Galicia or Poland. There at the train stations, these Abrahams were everywhere. Laughter and hand clapping at this. I'm sure he's referring here to the soldiers coming back from the war and finding when they arrive at the train station, all these Jews everywhere who never left, you know, who never served, who had been there, been on the back home doing business. And everybody understands that there. They penetrated into other races for millennia. And we know very well that wherever he stayed for longer, symptoms of decay appeared and the peoples could do nothing else than to liberate themselves from the uninvited guest or to disappear themselves. Heavy plagues came over the nations, no less than 10 in Egypt. The same plague we experience today firsthand. I should say, no less than 10 plagues came in Egypt. The same plague, Hitler says, that we're experiencing today firsthand. And finally, the Egyptians lost their patience. When the chronicler describes that the Jews suffered when they finally left, we know differently. For as soon as they were out, they began to long after coming back. More laughter. It seems, by the way, that they did not have it so badly. On the other hand, if it's true they had been forced to help build pyramids, it would mean today forcing them to earn their bread by working in our mines, stone quarries, etc. And just as you are not going to see this race voluntarily do it, so there was nothing left for the Egyptians but to force them. What hundreds of thousands of others do as a matter of course means for the Jew another chapter of suffering and persecution. Still later, the Jew was able to infiltrate the then soaring Roman Empire. We can still see his traces in southern Italy. Already 250 years before Christ, he was there in all places, and people began to avoid them. Already then and there, he made the most important decisions and was a trader. From numerous Roman texts, we know that he traded, like today, with everything from shoelaces to girls. And the audience says, "Hear, hear." And we know that the danger grew and that the insurrection after the murder of Julius Caesar was mainly fomented by the Jews. The Jew knew even then how to make friends with the masters of the earth. Only when they became shaky in their rule, he suddenly became a populist and discovered his wide open heart for the needs of the broad masses. So it was in Rome, as we know. We know that the Jew used Christianity, not out of love for Christ, but partly because he knew that this new religion questioned all earthly power, and so it became an axe at the root of the Roman state, the state which was built on the authority of the public servants. And he became its chief bearer and propagator without becoming a Christian. He couldn't. He remained a Jew, precisely as today when he, never stooping to the level of worker, remains a master pretending to be a socialist. "Bravo," says the audience. He did the same 2,000 years ago, and we know that this new teaching was nothing else than a resurrection of the old truism that people in a state should have legal rights, and above all, that equal duties should give equal rights. This obvious teaching was gradually turned against the Jew himself, as the similar teaching of socialism has to turn on the Hebrew race today, its distorters and corruptors. We know that throughout the Middle Ages, the Jew infiltrated all European states, behaving like a parasite, using new principles and ways which the peoples did not know then. And from a nomad, he became a greedy and bloodthirsty robber of our time. And he went so far that people after people rebelled and attempted to shake him off. We know it is untrue when people say that the Jew was forced to this activity. He could easily acquire land, and he did acquire land, but not to work it, but in order to use it as a trade object, just like he does today. Our forefathers were wiser. They knew that land was holy, and they excluded the Jew from it. You know, when Hitler, one of the laws that Hitler's government passed was to make it so that land could not be sold very easily, that families owned. It had to be passed on to the oldest son intact, not in little parcels given to each child, which would cause much more of many of them to sell off their parcel. And then that's when the Jews were buying it. So I think that's one thing he's referring to. And at this, there's a lively ovation from the people listening. And if the Jew ever had the intention to tend the land and build a state, he could easily have done so at the time when whole new continents were discovered. He could easily have done it if only he used a small part of his power, craftiness, cunning, brutality, and ruthlessness, as well as some of his financial resources. Because if this power was sufficient to subdue whole peoples, it would have been more than sufficient to build their own state. If only he had had the basic condition for this, which is a will to work, and not in the sense of usurious trade, but in the sense in which millions work in order to keep a state going. Instead, we see him also today as a destroyer. In these days, we see a great transformation. The Jew was once a court Jew, submissive to his master. He knew how to make the master pliable in order to dominate his subjects. For this purpose, he whetted the appetites of these great men for unattainable things, extended the credit, and soon turned them into debtors. In this way, he himself got power over peoples. And he played this game with the same cruelty as, a few years later, the humanistic and philanthropic Jew, whose wealth did not suffer at all when he showed his humanitarianism and his spirit of sacrifice to our people. Big laughter at this. I said that he transformed from court Jew, Hofjud, to populist Jew, Volksjud. Why? Because he felt that the ground began to burn under his feet. Gradually, also, he had to lead an existential struggle against the growing awakening and anger of the people. This forced him to lay his hands on the inner structure of the states if he wanted to remain the master of the peoples. We see the resulting destruction in three areas, namely those same three areas which were preserving and developing the states. Excuse me. The first area was to fight against the principle of the ethical duty to work. The Jew had found another kind of work for himself where he could earn gold without practically moving a finger. He developed a principle which, throughout millennia, made it possible for him to amass fortunes without sweat and toil, unlike all other mortals, and above all, without taking risk. What does the word industrial capital really mean? Ladies and gentlemen, people often accuse us, particularly in the factories, and I would say he's talking about workers mostly when he says people, they say, you don't fight against the industrial capital, just against finance and loan capital. And most people don't understand, Hitler is saying, and most people don't understand that one must not fight against industrial capital. What is industrial capital? It is a constantly changing factor, a relative concept. Once it was a needle and thread, a workshop, and a couple of cents in ready money, which a tailor in Nuremberg possessed in the 13th century. It was a sum that made work possible, that is, tools, workshops, and a certain amount of money in order to survive for a period of time. Gradually, this small workshop became a big factory. But workshops and tools, machines and factories have, per se, no value able to produce value, but are a means to an end. What produces value is work. And the few cents which made it possible to survive difficult times and buy some fabrics, multiplied through time and stand before us today. We call it capital for continued operation in bad times, that is working capital. Here I want to emphasize one thing. Tools, workshop, machines, factory, or working capital, that is industrial capital. Against this, you cannot fight at all. You can perhaps make sure that it is not abused, but you cannot fight against it. This is the first major scam that one makes to our people, and they make it to distract it from the real fight, to pull it off from the capital which should and must be fought, from the loan and financial capital. Now there's stormy applause and bravo, bravo. This capital arises in a very different way. The smallest master craftsman was dependent on the fate that might affect him every day, on the general situation in the Middle Ages, perhaps on the size of his city and its prosperity, the security of this city. And also today is this capital, that is the industrial capital, tied to the state and to the people, depending on the will of the people to work, but depending also on the possibility to procure raw materials in order to be able to offer work and find buyers who will really buy the product. And we know that a collapse of the state under certain circumstances renders the greatest values worthless, devalues them, as distinguished from the other capital, the finance and loan capital, which accrues interest very evenly without any regard to whether the owner, for example, of these 10,000 marks himself passes away or not. The debt remains on the estate. We experience that a state has debts, for example, the German Reich's bonds for Alsace-Lorraine railways. These bonds must bear interest, although the railways are no longer in our possession. We know that this railway, fortunately, has now a 20 billion deficit, but their bonds must bear interest. And even though they were sold, in part, more than 60 years ago, and have already been repaid four times, the debt, the interest, runs further. And while a great nation wins nothing on this company, it still must bleed. The loan capital continues to grow completely irrespective of any outside disturbance. Here we already see the first possibility, namely that this kind of money-making, which is independent of all the events and incidents of daily life, must necessarily, because it is never hindered and always runs evenly, gradually lead to huge capitals, which are so enormous that they ultimately only have one fault, namely the difficulty of their further accommodation. To accommodate this capital, you have to proceed to destroying whole states, to destroy entire cultures, to abolish national industries, not to socialize, but to throw all into the jaws of this international capital, because this capital is international, as the only thing on this earth that is truly international. It is international because its carrier, the Jews, are international through their distribution across the world. It says there is consent to this. And already here, one should knock oneself on the head and say, if this capital is international because its carrier is distributed internationally, it must be madness to think that this capital can be fought internationally with the help of the members of the same race which possesses it. Hear, hear, they say. Fire is not extinguished by fire, but by water, and the international capital belonging to the international Jew can only be broken by a national force. Bravo and applause. So this capital has grown to incredibly large proportions and today virtually rules the earth, still eerily growing, and the worst is completely corrupting all honest work. For it is appalling that the common man who has to bear the burden in order to return the capital sees that, despite his hard work, diligence, thrift, and in spite of the real work, he is hardly able to nourish himself and still less to dress while this international capital devours billions just in interest, which also he must supply, and at the same time a whole racial stratum which does no other work than collect interest and cut coupons spreads in the state. This is a degradation of any honest work, for every honestly working man must ask today, does it have a purpose at all that I work? I will never really accomplish anything, and there are people who, without work, practically, can not only live, but in practice even dominate us, and that's their goal. Yes, one of the foundations of our strength is being destroyed, namely the ethical concept of work. And that was a brilliant idea of Karl Marx to falsify the ethical concept of work and the whole mass of the people who groan under the capital are to be organized for the destruction, of the national economy and for the protection of international finance and loan capital. There is stormy applause at this. We know that today, billions of industry capital is facing $500 billion of loan capital. These $15 billion of industry capital is invested in creative values, while this $500 billion loan capital, which we always get in spoonful rates of $6 and $7 billion, and which we use in periods of 1 to 2 months to supplement our rations a little, these $6 to $7 billion today, which are decreed almost worthless scraps of paper, at a later date, should we ever recover, will have to be repaid in high quality money, that is, in a money behind which lies practical work. This is not only the destruction of a state, but already the application of a chain, of a neck collar for later times. And, for later times. I mean, he wasn't thinking about this, probably, but this is exactly what the Germans have undergone since Hitler's death. Since the end of the war, they have a chain, a neck collar around each and every one of them, where they are, not only has their state been destroyed, but, you know, they are the servants of the people who've done so. The second pillar against which the Jew as a parasite turns and must turn is the national purity as a source of the strength of a nation. The Jew, who is himself a nationalist more than any other nation, who through millennia did not mix with any other race, uses intermingling just for others to degenerate them in the best case. This same Jew preaches every day with thousands of tongues from 19,000 papers in Germany alone, that all nations on earth are equal, that international solidarity should bind all the peoples, that no people can lay a claim to a special status, etc., and above all, that no nation has a reason to be proud of anything that is called or is national. What a nation means, he who himself never dreams of climbing down to those to whom he preaches internationalism, and knows well why. First, a race must be denationalized. This is what he's saying there, according to the Jews. First, it must unlearn that its power is in its blood, and when it has reached the level where it has no more pride, the result is a product, a second race, which is lower than the previous one. And the Jew needs the lower one in order to organize his final world domination. In order to build it and keep it, he lowers the racial level of the other peoples so that only he is racially pure and able to eventually rule over all the others. That's race degradation, the effects of which we can see today in a number of peoples of the world. We know that the Hindus in India are a mixed people, stemming from the high Aryan immigrants and from the dark Aborigines. And this nation bears the consequences, for it is a slave nation of a race that may seem in many ways almost as a second Jewry. Another problem is the problem of physical decomposition of races. The Jew is trying to eliminate all of which he knows that is somehow strengthening, muscle stealing, and eliminate above everything of that which he knows may keep a race so healthy that it will remain determined not to tolerate him, the Jew, among themselves, national criminals, It will remain determined not to tolerate among themselves national criminals, pests to the national community, but under some circumstances, punish them with death. And that is his great fear and worry, yes, that we will see what he's doing and punish him with death. For even the heaviest latches of the safest prison are not so tough, and the prison is not so safe that a few million could not open it eventually. Only one lock is permanent, and that is death. And in front of it, he has the most awe. and therefore he seeks to abolish this barbaric punishment everywhere where he lives as a parasite. You know, the Jews are famous for totally being against having a death penalty in a country and just, you know, taking away that you know, what causes people to not commit things that that have a death penalty attached to them. But wherever he already is Lord, it is used ruthlessly. Loud applause at this. Wherever the Jew already is, the death, I don't know. I won't try to explain. I'm probably confusing it. And for the breaking of physical strength, he has excellent means at hand. First of all, he has the trade that should be nothing more than distribution of foodstuffs and other necessary items for daily use. He uses it to withdraw these articles of daily life when necessary in order to raise the price on the one hand, but also to withdraw in order to create the conditions for physical weakening, which have always worked best, hunger. Thus we see them brilliantly organized from a Joseph in Egypt up to a Rathenau today. Now Rathenau's mother, became foreign minister of Germany during the Weimar Republic. He was assassinated in 1922, 2 months after signing the Rapallo Treaty with Italy. He was a leading proponent of a policy of assimilation for German Jews, and he was Jewish. His mother was Jewish. Hitler is just comparing how these Jews operate and organize from Joseph in Egypt up to this Rathenau in Germany. This was in 1920, and he was assassinated in 1922. Well, we're going to our break, ladies and gentlemen. When we come back, we'll continue and complete this, and hope you stay with me. I'll see you after the break.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht, und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. vermisset ich. Und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to the Heretics Hour on January 28th. Well, I'm reading a speech, a newly discovered, at least in English, speech by Adolf Hitler entitled Why We Are Anti-Semites, a speech that I had read several years ago that existed. And boy, I thought I looked for that. I couldn't find it. And finally, my wish has come true, and I have it thanks to Hasso Kastorp, who I talked about earlier. And so I'm going to continue, and we can catch up with anything else after I finish reading it. Now I'm in the part now where Hitler is describing how Jews destroy states, the states that they live in, but do not see themselves as really a part of. So he had just said, thus, we see them brilliantly organized from a Joseph in Egypt up to a Rathenau today. Everywhere, what we see behind these organizations is not the desire to make a shining organization for food supply, but through them gradually to create hunger. We know that as a politician, he never had reason and cause to shun the hunger. On the contrary, wherever the Jew appeared in political parties, hunger and misery was the soil in which only he could grow. He desires it, and therefore he does not even think of easing social misery. That's the bed in which it thrives. Hand in hand with this should probably have been in which he thrives. Hand in hand with this goes a battle against the health of the people. He knows how to turn all the healthy, normal manners, the obvious hygienic rules of a race on its head. From night, he makes day. He creates the notorious nightlife and knows exactly that it works slowly but surely, gradually destroying the healthy race, the healthy strength of a race, making it soft. The one is destroyed physically, the other spiritually. And into the heart of the third, it puts the hatred as he has to see the other's feast. And finally, as a last resort, he destroys the productive capacity and, if necessary, in connection with it, the productive resources of a nation. That is the great mystery of Russia. They have destroyed factories not because they knew they would no longer be needed, but because they knew that the people would be forced with enormous hardships to replace what had been destroyed. So the Jew succeeds in harnessing the people. Instead of the former 9 and 10 hours, for 12 hours. For at the moment when the Jew becomes Lord, he knows no 8-hour day. He recognizes his Sabbath for his cattle, but not for the golem, for the Akum, or Akum, A-K-U-M. Finally, he reaches for the last method, the destruction of all culture, of all that we consider as belonging in a state which we consider civilized. Here is his work, perhaps most difficult to recognize. But here the actual effect is the most terrible. We are familiar with his activity in the arts, like today's paintings, which became a caricature of all that we call true inner perception. Prolonged applause at this. They always explain that you don't understand the inner experience of the artist. Don't you think also that a Moritz Schwind and Ludwig Richter experienced internally when they created? Stormy bravo and applause from the listeners. Boy, they know that about the art. These are some of their great painters, Schwind and Richter. Don't you finally believe that, for example, Beethoven's chords also came from inner experience and feeling, and that a Beethoven symphony reflects his inner experience? This is true inner experience, unlike the other ones, which are only superficial swindle, applause, set in the world with an intent to gradually destroy in the people any healthy idea, and to whip the people into a state in which no one can understand whether the times are crazy or whether he himself is mad. Now there's big laughter and applause at this. Just as he works in painting, sculpture, and music, so he does in poetry and especially in literature. Here he has a great advantage. He is the editor and above all publisher. Now by he means the Jew. He is the editor and above all publisher of more than 95% of all newspapers. He uses this power, and he who has become such a brutal anti-Semite as myself, laughter, smells out, even as he takes the paper in his hand, where the Jew begins, more laughter. He knows already from the title page that it is again not one of us, but one of the folks behind. Now, laughter at that. I think the folks behind is what they were used to calling those who did not fight in the war but stayed behind. We know full well that all his contortions and words and wordplays only serve to conceal the inner emptiness of his mind and hide the fact that the man has no real spiritual life, and what he lacks in true spirit he replaces with bombast phrases, word twists, and turns that seem unreasonable. But he cautiously explains from the outset that he who does not understand them is not sufficiently mentally developed. Laughter. When we talk about literature, we also need to jump straight to another chapter where we can admire in excess Moritz and Salomon, Wolf and Bear. I think these are Jews. Our theater, the places which a Richard Wagner wanted once to have darkened to create the highest degree of consecration and seriousness in which he wanted to perform works which would be shameful to call shows, so he named them consecration plays, the place where there should be nothing else but the highest elevation, a detachment of the individual from all the grief and misery, but also from all the rot which surrounds us in life, to lift the individual into a purer air. Now here he is sounding religious, is he not? What has become of it, a place which today you are ashamed to enter unless someone might notice you the moment you go in? Hear, hear, the audience says. We see that although Friedrich Schiller received just $346 for Mary Stuart, a play of his, for Merry Widow, people today receive $5.5 million. For the greatest kitsch today makes millions, for which an author in ancient Greece would probably have been expelled from the state, by ostracism of the state. Loud applause at this. Well, you know, I have to tell you that Adolf Hitler did change some of his things that he, his tastes, for certain things, and he later decided that The Merry Widow, even though it's an operetta, not an opera, was very good and excellent. And he supported it, and it was put into the repertory of, you know, Germany at that time. Whereas at this time, he was really dismissing, he dismissed The Merry Widow quite a bit as something superficial and not worthy of anybody to be looking at things like that, you know, going to see things like that. And if theater has become a hotbed of vice and shamelessness, then 1,000 times more so that new invention, which perhaps comes from genial inspiration, but which the Jew understood right away to remodel into the filthiest business that you can imagine, the cinema. Thunderous applause and clapping. At first, people attached greatest hopes to this brilliant invention. It could become an easy mediator of profound knowledge for the entire people of the world. And what has become of it? It became the mediator of the greatest and most shameless filth. The Jew works on. For him, there is no spiritual sensitivity. And just as his forefather Abraham was selling his wife, he finds nothing special about the fact that today he sells girls. And through the centuries, we find him everywhere, in North America as in Germany, Austria-Hungary, and all over the East, as the merchant of the human commodity. And it cannot be denied away. Even the greatest Jew defender cannot deny that all of these girl dealers are Hebrews. This subject is atrocious. According to Germanic sentiment, there would be only one punishment for this, death. For people that play fast and loose regarding as a business, as a commodity, for what millions of others means greatest happiness or greatest misfortune. For them, love, for them the Jew, love is nothing more than business in which they make money. They are always ready to tear apart the happiness of any marriage if only 30 pieces of silver can be made. Stormy bravo and applause. They tell us today that all that which was known as family life is a completely outlived notion. And who only saw the play Castle Wettenstein could see how the holiest that still remained to the people was shamelessly called brothel. Well, I looked that up. Castle Wettenstein was an anti-bourgeois play, you know, avant-garde type thing, written in 1912 by Frank Wedekind. He was a German. It was kind of about loveless realism, you know, the new kind of realism. And a young woman is corrupted, you know, it's a whole saga about that. And it's kind of terrible. But it became the kind of, the Jews took it as, even though it wasn't written by a Jew, and, you know, really promoted it and praised it and made it the, you know, the kind of the flagship of the new type of playwriting and drama that they were promoting. So Hitler goes on, and we should not be surprised when he also attacks what many people even today are not indifferent to, and what many at least can give inner peace, religion. So attention to that. He is addressing the value of religion for the people. And it certainly is something good when you compare it to what they were trying to put in his place. Also, here we see the same Jew who himself has enough religious customs which others could easily mock, but no one does, as we in principle never ridicule religion because it is sacred to us. That's another statement you should take note of. He says we in principle never ridicule religion because it is sacred to us. And when he says us, he means all of us, our people, his people, you know, which he includes, you know, he cares. He doesn't separate himself from them and say, like so many today are doing who consider themselves big truth tellers, oh, the people are so stupid, you know, and I'm so smart. I know better than them, but they're so stupid. They need all this stuff. Hitler never talked like that. Certainly he never talked like that publicly. But he tries, now this is Hitler again, but he tries to destroy everything without offering a substitute. Who today, in this age of the vilest deceit and swindle, is detached from it? For him, there are just two more possibilities. Either he hangs himself in despair or becomes a crook. When the Jew has destroyed the state according to these three major aspects, work, national purity, culture, when he has undermined, those were the three major aspects. When he has undermined the state-forming and sustaining power, the ethical conception of work, the racial purity of a people and its spiritual life, he puts to acts the authority of reason in the state and puts in its place the so-called authority of the majority of the crowd. And he knows that this majority will dance as he whistles because he has the means to direct it. He has the press, not perhaps for registering a public opinion, but for forgery of it, for he knows how to harness public opinion through the press in order to dominate the state. Instead of the authority of reason, there enters the authority of the great spongy majority led by the Jew, because the Jew is always going through three periods. And these are, first, autocratically minded, ready to serve any prince. He then descends to the people, fighting for democracy, of which he knows that it will be his hand, and steered by him. He owns it. He becomes a dictator. This sounds like Hitler was reading the protocols of the Elders of Zion at this time, which was 1920, which he no doubt had seen it, and he may be, seems to be a little influence in his wording, in the way he's just putting things according to that. So he says, the audience says, hear, hear, when he says he becomes a dictator. And we see this today in Russia, where a Lenin has just assured the councils are already outlived, and that now it is not absolutely necessary that a proletarian state be led through one council or parliament, that it is sufficient that two or three proletarian-minded people govern this country. These proletarian-minded persons are some Jewish billionaires, and proletarian-minded. And we know very well that behind two or three proletarians ultimately stands another organization, which is outside of the state, the Alliance Israelite and their grandiose propaganda organization and the Organization of Freemasonry. Loud applause and clapping of hands. Now, when I was researching and talking about the protocols, I found that the Alliance Israelite Universelle in France seemed to me to be a very key institution that was the first one that was organized. It was organized under the direction, really, of this Cremieux. Adolf was his name. Adolf Cremieux, big Jew. And it was the first one to make itself very much international and to call on all Jews all around the world to see themselves as part of the nation, the Israelite nation. Now, anyway, I was kind of surprised. Anyway, I took note that Hitler is mentioning this here, and mentioning Freemasonry, and the people respond very much to that. They know what he's talking about, and they know about it too. And he goes on, and in all these things, we must understand that there are no good or evil Jews. Here, everyone works exactly according to the instincts of his race, because the race, or should we say the nation and its character, as the Jew himself explains, lies in blood. And this blood is forcing everyone to act according to these principles, whether he is the leading mind in a party that calls itself democratic or calls itself socialist or a man of science, literature, or just an ordinary exploiter. He is a Jew. He works aglow with one thought. How do I get up? How do I get my people to become the master race? And Hitler uses that term, the master race, here. And, was this something that the Jews used, or how did this work? I mean, did they steal this name and turn it on the Germans and accuse the Germans of considering themselves the master race? Because Germans never used that term at all. I was just wondering, because he uses it here, for the Jews, and their thinking. Okay, notice again that he said there's no good or evil Jews. I think it'll come up some more, that he doesn't believe in the good Jew theory. So continuing, And when we see, for example, in these Jewish magazines, it is specified that every Jew everywhere is obligated to fight against any anti-Semite, wherever and whoever he is, then it follows by deduction that every German, wherever and whoever he is, will become an anti-Semite. Stormy bravo and prolonged applause. For if the Jew has a racial determination, so have we, and we are also obliged to act accordingly, because it seems inseparable from the social idea, and we do not believe that there could ever exist a state with lasting inner health if it is not built on internal social justice. And so we have joined forces with this knowledge, and when we finally united, it was only one big question. How should we actually baptize ourselves? A party? A bad name? Now here he's moved into talking about he and his group of people in the NSDAP have decided in the face of this idea that every German has to act as a German and respond accordingly. And so he says, how should we actually baptize ourselves? A party? A bad name? Notorious, discredited in the mouth of everyone, and hundreds told us, why have you called yourself a party? When I hear that word, I go mad, and others told us it is not necessary for us to organize ourselves more closely. It is sufficient that the scientific knowledge of the danger of Jewry gradually deepens, and the individual, on the basis of this knowledge, begins to remove the Jews from himself. But I very much fear that this whole beautiful line of thought was designed by none other than a Jew himself. There's laughter at that. And now he's saying here that people have criticized that they formed a party and that they have a bad name for their party and that that they don't need a party. They don't need to organize this much. If they just put out the, now this is current today, this is so current within what we discussed today, that it's enough to put out the knowledge of what Jews are all about and tell people, and on that basis, people will start to catch on and remove the Jews from their own circle and so on. But Hitler doesn't go for that, and he says he thinks this is designed by none other than a Jew himself. Then we were told further, it is not necessary that you are politically organized. It is sufficient to take away from the Jews their economic power. Well, we hear that too. Economic organizing only. Here lies the salvation and the future. Here too, I have the same suspicion that a Jew sowed the idea for the first time, because one thing has become clear. In order to liberate our economy from this fix, it is necessary to combat the pathogen, the politically organized struggle of the masses against their oppressors. Stormy applause. Since it is clear that scientific knowledge is worthless as long as this knowledge is not a basis for an organization of the masses for the implementation of what we consider necessary, and it is further clear that for this organization, only the broad masses of our people can be considered, because it sets us apart from all those who today are saviors of Germany, whether Bothmer or Ballerstedt. And these are two men, he's saying, saviors of Germany, when I'm reading, I pretty soon I can't think anymore. He's saying saviors of Germany in a smart aleck sense, kind of. He doesn't really mean it. Facetious way. Bothmer and Ballerstedt were both public men who were opponents of Hitler and what he stood for. So he says, whether they are these two, that we believe that the future strength of our people is not to be found in Odeon Barr or Bonbonnière, these are sort of like places of ill repute, or just places of, you know, popular entertainment that he said, that don't keep the people lifted up. But in the countless, he says, but we don't, our future strength is not in these places, but in the countless workshops in which they work every day, that in these be considered millions of hardworking, healthy people's lives is the only hope of our people for the future. Loud applause. You can see that Hitler was not a person who was liberal in the sense that, well, he didn't want to, you know, ask too much of people. He saw German people as working, as healthy, as racially pure, and all of these things, and that without that, Germany could not ever, you know, would succumb because it was under attack. Further, we realize that if this movement does not penetrate into the masses, organize them, then everything will be in vain. Then we will never be able to liberate our people, and we will never be able to think of rebuilding our country. The salvation can never come from above. It can and will only come from the masses, from the bottom up. Applause at this. You know, the greatest fear of the Jews now is that what Hitler did will rise again. And I said that earlier. And it's so clear that they are deathly afraid of this. And of course, they think that it can't happen because they have total control and they don't allow it, anything. But this is their fear, because this is the one thing that can defeat them, his ideas. And as we came to this realization and decided to form a party, a political party, that wants to enter into the ruthless political struggle for the future, then we heard a voice. Do you believe that you few can do it? Do you really believe that a couple of guys can do it? Because we understood that we had an immense battle ahead of us, but also that anything created by men can be destroyed by others. And another conviction has arisen within us, that this cannot be a matter of whether we think we can do it, but only a question of whether we believe that it is right and that it is necessary. And if it is right and necessary, then it is no longer a question of whether we want to, but rather it is our duty to do what we feel is necessary. Stormy bravo at this. We did not ask after money and supporters, but we decided to go forth. And while others are working a whole generation, perhaps in order to get a small house or to have a carefree retirement, we put our lives at stake and have begun this difficult struggle. If we win, and we are convinced we will, we may die penniless. We will have helped create the biggest movement, which will now extend over all Europe and the whole world. Loud applause at this. The first three principles were clear, and they are inseparable from each other. Socialism as the final concept of duty, the ethical duty of work, not just for oneself, but for one's fellow man's sake, and above all the principle, common good before own good, a struggle against all parasitism, and especially against easy and unearned income. And we were aware that in this fight we can rely on no one but our own people. Okay, so he says, for one's work for one's fellow man's sake, but he means our own people. And in the fight, also, this is very important, we can rely on no one but our own people. We are convinced that socialism is the right, in the right sense, will only be possible in nations and races that are Aryan. And there, in the first place, we hope for our own people and are convinced that socialism is inseparable from nationalism. Loud applause. To be nationalist does not mean for us to belong to one party or another, but to show with every action that one benefits the people. It means love for all the people without exception. From this point of view, we will realize that it is necessary to preserve the most precious thing a people has, the sum of all active creative powers of its workers, and keep it healthy in body and soul. Cheers at this. And this view of nationalism compels us immediately to form a front against the opposition. or the opposite, the Semitic conception of the idea of people, and especially against the Semitic concept of work. Since we are socialists, we must necessarily also be anti-Semites, because we want to fight against the very opposite. I think that's a little bit written a little bit wrong there. We want to fight against materialism and mammonism. And when today the Jew still runs into our factories and says, how can you be a socialist anti-Semite? Are you not ashamed? There comes a time in which we will ask, how can you not be an anti-Semite being a socialist? Hear, hear, say the listeners. There comes a time when it will be obvious that socialism can only be carried out accompanied by nationalism and anti-Semitism. The three concepts are inseparably connected. They are the foundations of our program, and therefore we call ourselves National Socialists. Cheers. Finally, we know how great the social reforms must be so that Germany may recover. That is, I say that a little differently. We know how great the reforms must be so that Germany may recover, the social reforms. If it doesn't happen, perhaps the only reason will be too modest efforts. We know that one will have to cut deep. We will not be able to come around the national problem and the issue of land reform and the problem of care for all those who, day after day, are working for the community and in their old age, that this care must not be a pittance, but they have a right in their old days which are still worth living. If we wish to make these social reforms, this must go hand in hand with the fight against the enemy of every social institution, Jewry. You know, when Jews make out that they are the ones who care about social welfare and so on. Here, too, we know that scientific knowledge can only be the groundwork, but that behind this knowledge must stand an organization which one day will be able to go over into action. And in this action, we will remain adamant, which means removal of Jews from amongst our people. Loud and long sustained applause and clapping. Not because we begrudge them their existence. We congratulate the rest of the world on account of their visits. Great hilarity now from the people. But because we value the existence of our own people 1,000 times higher than that of an alien race. And they say, bravo. You know, when he said we congratulate the rest of the world on account of their visits, that's one of his, his humorous, he was so witty. But it was so underdone, you know, it was subtle. If the Jews visit other people in the world, they will congratulate them for going there, you know. And since we are convinced that this scientific anti-Semitism that clearly recognizes the terrible danger of this race for any people, it can only be a guide, and the masses will always perceive them emotionally, for they know the Jews first and foremost as the man in daily life who always and everywhere sticks out. Our concern must be to arouse in our people the instinct against Jewry and whip it up and stir until it comes to the decision to join the movement, his movement, which is willing to take the consequences. Bravo and applause. When people tell us whether you succeed depends eventually on whether you have the sufficient money, etc. To this, I think, I can say the following. Even the power of money is somehow limited. There is a certain limit beyond which eventually not the money rules, but the truth. And we are all aware that once the millions of our workers realize who are the leaders who now promise them a blissful future kingdom, he's talking about the Weimar Republic leaders, when they recognize that everywhere gold is at play, they will throw them the gold in the face and declare, keep your gold and don't think that you can buy us. Bravo, the folks say. And we do not despair if we maybe still stand alone. And if we today, wherever we go, do see potential supporters, but nowhere the courage to join in the organization. That should not lead us astray. We have accepted the fight, and we must win it. I have assured you before the election that this election would not decide Germany's fate, that after this election, no recovery would come. And already today, I think most of you will agree with me. I could predict it back then because I knew that the courage and the will to act were absent everywhere. We have proclaimed as our election platform only one thing. Let the others go to the polls today, to the Reichstag, to the parliaments, and loll in their club chairs. We want to climb up the beer tables and pull the masses with us. We've kept this promise and we'll keep it in the future, tirelessly and constantly, as long as we have a spark of strength and a breath in the lungs. We will come out and call all our people and always tell the truth until we can begin to hope that this truth will prevail, till the day finally comes when our words fall silent and action begins. Now there's stormy bravo and long-lasting applause. There's pause and discussion. There was some discussion. And then there's closing remarks of the speaker. And before I go to those, which I want to check, and if anybody wants to call and comment on this, we still have 25 minutes, so 23 minutes. So you can call in at 1-830-443-4911. 1-830-443-4911, and say what you want about what I've read and what you think about this. Now, let me go to the email. I don't have any emails about the show. So I will, you know, I'm, of course, you know, when I post this, you can read it, but I think that he says a lot of things here which are things that we can follow and see how they fit our situation today. I realize that they had a different population there, had a much better population than we have, well, here in the U.S., but then I'm sure there's a lot of Europeans and other, you know, Australians and so on, listening and be interested in this, in this speech, and can gain some tips from it. So it's not just here in the United States where we have this really difficult situation, but we should be working with our people. I don't see anybody doing that. I know it's not easy, but we just, nobody has that kind of will that these men, these few men, decided upon. Mainly because of the power of Adolf Hitler and the strength of his thinking, his will, his wonderful speeches and so on that, you know, rallied the people so much. But it doesn't mean that, that it cannot be done. You know, there are people who may, you know, who may not seem quite ready, but there are some people who, could possibly be effective. I'm going to go on. He made some closing remarks. Ladies and gentlemen, we are not so dreadful as our first enemy, and we cannot shatter Jewry by ourselves. We do not imagine it is so easy. However, we have decided we have decided not to come with any buts and ifs. But once the matter comes to the solution, it will be done and done thoroughly. What the gentleman said, somebody that was discussing something, that for him it doesn't matter. Any person is a human being. Don't we hear that a lot? It doesn't matter if somebody is Jewish or whatever. Everybody is a human being. Let's just look at him as an individual. Hitler says, I agree, as long as that person does not get in the way. But when a great race systematically destroys the life conditions of my race, I say no matter where they belong, In that case, I say that I am one of those who, when they get a blow on the left cheek, they return two or three. Now, there's a bravo at that. So he's saying, you know, we need to fight people who are destroying the life of our life. And then a gentleman said that our movement would mean a battle into which the working class should be drawn. Yes, and we will promise our people heaven on earth. And after the fools have fought for 40 years, now instead of the heaven, they'll have nothing but a pile of rubble and misery. That mistake we will not make. Bravo to that. We do not promise any heaven, but the one thing that if you are determined to carry out this program in Germany, maybe once again the time will come in which you will be able to have a life. If you carry out the glorious reform which these gentlemen here wish, he's speaking about the commies, the communists, when he says that, I think, you will, in an even shorter time, stand before the need to embellish this life with the very same decrees which their leaders, Trotsky and Lenin, issue now. Those who are not willing to fight for the blessing of that state die. He's talking about in Russia. And, of course, he's sarcastic about the blessings of that state. Finally, he said, I don't know who he is now, I've lost that, whoever he's talking about, the person who was questioning him or something. Finally, he said that they opposed any capitalism. My esteemed audience, the communists have so far been merely fighting industrial capital and only hung industrial capitalists. But name me one Jewish capitalist whom they have hung. Getting back to that difference between the industrial capitalist and the finance capitalist. Hadding, Scott has talked a lot about that. So he says he says 300,000 Russians have been murdered in Russia. The Soviet government itself admits this now. Among those 300,000 is not a single Jew. But in the leadership, more than 90% are Jews. Is that persecution of Jews, or rather, in the truest sense of the word, persecution of Christians? Hear, hear, says the audience. Then you said you fought against both the loan capital as industrial capital. But he means you fought against both of them. But you have so far combated neither the one nor the other. You cannot fight the industrial capital, at most destroy it. And then you must again start with a 12-hour working day to rebuild it. Hear, hear, say the people. And the other you've so far never fought. This one is paying you. Thunderous applause and clapping of hands. I don't know. He's talking about the communists, you know, either in Russia or in Germany or anywhere, that they have never fought against the loan capital, the finance capital. They fight against the industrial capital and destroy the country, and then it has to be built up again because it's necessary. It's a part of the national wealth and so on. Okay. Then the second speaker, now he's answering speakers. So he says, then the second speaker stated the cause of the revolution should be looked for in poverty. Isn't that? They've probably got some communist people there pretending that they're neutral listeners. We prefer to put it this way. Poverty has made Germany ripe for those who wanted the revolution. And you can read the piece written by their lord and master, who was then ruling Germany, Rathenau, that same guy as before, where he explained precisely that the revolution had a real and deliberate purpose, displacement of the feudal system and its replacement by plutocracy. These men have been the financiers of this glorious movement. If their revolution would have been even the slightest threat to the capital, then the Frankfurter Zeitung, you know, a big major newspaper, financial newspaper, would not have, on the 9th November, announced triumphantly, the German people have made a revolution. When we make our revolution, the Frankfurter Zeitung will whistle a very different tune. Loud applause to that. Then you said further, before the war, one has not heard anything of Jews. That is a sad fact that we have heard so little. This does not mean, however, that he was not there. But above all, it is not true, because this movement has not begun after the war, but has been there just as long as there are Jews. He means the movement of the Jews, you know, what the Jews are doing as a movement. If you go back and read in Jewish history, the Jews gradually exterminated the original tribes in Palestine by the sword. So you can imagine that there has been anti-Semitism as a logical reaction. And it existed the whole time till this day. And the pharaohs in Egypt were probably just as anti-Semitic as we are today. If you had before the war not only read their famous writers, Moritz, Salomon, etc., I do not even mention newspapers, which a priori carry the stamp of approval of the Alliance Israelite, that's that Alliance Israelite Universelle from France, and they did put out their own paper, Imperium magazine and so on, you would not have heard that in Austria was a huge anti-Semitic movement. But also in Russia, people constantly attempted to rise up against the Jewish bloodsuckers. That is, in Galicia, the Poles groaned and no longer worked, and sometimes rose in despair against those crazy idealists who were hell-bound to send the people to their early graves. You know, the idealists were these communists who had this idea of the workers' paradise. Unfortunately, too late, we have begun to understand this here. But you say, before the war, one has not heard of it. But really deplorable are only those who hear it now and still cannot get the courage to answer our call. Stormy bravo and applause. Then you declare further that Lenin made some mistakes. We are grateful that at least you admit that your Pope has made mistakes. Laughter. But then you declare that you would not make these mistakes. You would not make these mistakes. For one thing, when 300,000 people are hanged in Germany, and when our whole economy is shattered after their pattern, the Russian pattern, then is your statement that you would not make the same mistakes not enough? You seem to have a poor idea of what the Bolshevik system really means. It will not improve the situation, but it is put there in order to destroy the races with these errors. Hear, hear. When you declare today that one did so in Russia up to now, this is a sorry excuse. When you first exterminate a race, first totally ruin a national economy, and finally this state lives practically only by the mercy of Tsarist officers who, driven by force, make conquests for it, then in my opinion, it's a strange policy. I don't know. Let me repeat that. When you declare today that one did so in Russia up to now, this is a sorry excuse. When you first exterminate a race, first totally ruin a national economy, and finally this state lives practically only by the mercy of Tsarist officers who, driven by force, make conquests for it, then in my opinion, it's a strange policy. One thing I know is that if we do not have the iron will to stop war madness, that mutual tearing one another to pieces will perish. One thing I know is that if we do not have the iron will to stop war madness, that mutual tearing one another to pieces will perish. Finally, you explain, since the loan capital is international, we cannot fight it nationally, otherwise the international world will shut us off. These are the consequences of relying on international solidarity. Loud applause. Had you not made us so powerless, we could not have cared less if the other world is happy with us or not. But when you yourself admit that this international, which practically dominates Britain, France, and North America, is able to shut us off, and this is already in 1920 he's saying this, do you believe then that the fight against the capital is being fought over there? So long as this earth exists, nations have never been freed by the will and the deed of other nations, but either by their own force or they remained in bondage. Cheers to this. Again, you know, it's up to us to do, to fight for our own, and it's not up to us to wait for someone else to do it, as so many seem to think will happen if we join forces with other people. And then, finally, you also turn to the Bible. And that's, after all, a good sign in a communist. The people laugh at this. And you explain that because of a peculiar conformity of Bible and our party program, I am a communist. What you are telling me here, Dr. Gerlich has already said, and Mr. Holman has called me too. If you stand up for what you have in the program, you are a communist. On the other hand, the Post says all the time, I guess that's a newspaper, I am an arch reactionary, a completely diseased militaristic reactionary. And then it says here, interruption, that somebody must have called out, the Post is itself reactionary. And Hitler goes on, would you please confront the chief editor with this and allow me to listen? He wanted to hear what the, somebody would tell chief editor of the Post that, and he wanted to be able to listen to it. Big laughter and applause at this. Also, the Kampf, that's another newspaper, Kampf meaning struggle, the Kampf emphasizes again and again that we are the bastion of the counter-reaction. So I recommend that you go first to Post and to Kampf and tell them that we are communists, because I myself couldn't care less how I am called, whether reactionary, pan-German, a Junker, or, you know, Junker spelled J-U-N-K-E-R, a big industrialist, or a communist. I am and will remain a German National Socialist and have my program in front of me. And as I said earlier, I will pursue it to the last spark of my strength and the last breath in my lungs. There's long sustained stormy bravado and applause at this. And that brings it to an end. And the chairman thanks for the numerous attendance, the many people that were there, and closes the meeting. And that's all I have to read. I would like it if somebody would call in, but nobody seems to want to call and comment on this. There's a lot that could be commented on. I could go back and say a few things that I let go that I haven't read here. Let me look one more time at the mailbox. Now the idea that this, let me read this since I have the time here. This comes from someone in Britain. All right, he says, I might as well use this, it's a comment, it was sent in before the show. I think though that this is a, I'm not going to read it all because I think it's somebody who, again, I think it might be a Christian identist or British Israel or something that is saying, you know, that some bunch of stuff. But assuming the 1920 speech attributed to Adolf Hitler is genuine, is there any possibility of this speech being, being reproduced on your website? Yes, it will be. God's chosen, he says, Eastern European Asiatic Mongol Khazars, claim that Adolf Hitler wrote a letter dated 1919 detailing his alleged plans for the liquidation of God's chosen. I have seen a copy of this letter, and it is a complete forgery. Well, sure. I've heard about that. Now he says, though, Adolf Hitler's alleged speech, Why We Are Anti-Semites, has a very hollow ring about it, since Adolf Hitler was too intelligent to be taken in by the claim that God's chosen, Eastern European Asiatic Mongol Khazars, are a Semitic race, because the history of the Asiatic Mongol Khazars was known among academics and historians, and it is very much the case that there are many academics who know that God's chosen are neither Jews or Semites, and academia deliberately conceals this fact because to reveal this fact would impact on the career prospects of academics and historians. And then he sent me to a link which wasn't anything there. What was supposed to be there wasn't there. So, All right. This is something that we hear from a lot of people, that we shouldn't use the word Semite, because and also he is saying that the chosen, the Jews, are not Jews. He's calling them God's chosen, because there aren't, you know, Jews are not Semites, or the Jews are not the Jews, and all of that. But Hitler is going by the more traditional thinking of the Bible being an Old Testament, a product of the Jews, and so on. Even though he held that Jesus of Nazareth was not a Jew, that he was, you know, there in the where he was born in that area. I can't even think of it now. I know all this stuff in the Bible quite well, but my mind's not functioning too well. So, but you know, so there's that. But this I think, you know, people say, well, don't call them the Jews. They're not Jews. They're this, they're that. You have to call them God's chosen. Well, that's just they're not God's chosen either. So, they call themselves, they use the term anti-Semite. They use the term anti-Semitic. And this term has been around for a long time, this word. And it's the reason I think this is so important now, well, now I've thought of something to say and now I'm going to run out of time. But the reason this is so important is that we are being inundated with propaganda and publicity more and more from the Jews, from their newspapers and, you know, their media. A lot of it is in Jewish media that is not in the mainstream media, which is also Jewish, but not outwardly Jewish. And so they don't carry all that stuff, but the Jewish media constantly has got it. And, you know, oh, anti-Semitism is growing. Oh, anti-Semitism is on the creep. We have to stop anti-Semitism. They're working on it now in the European Union Parliament, you know. Oh, if a person doesn't like, you know, says anything against Jews, they're supposed to be kicked out of Parliament. These Jews want to control that kind of a thing, you know. And so this, I want to talk about anti-Semitism, and I want us to say, you know, yeah, we're anti-Semites, and tell us what's wrong with anti-Semitism. Why are you so upset about anti-Semitism? And get talking about where it comes from, which we all know, and why it's there, and why Jews provoke it, and why Jews are the reason for it, and that we have to be, if we want to save ourselves from genocide, we have to be anti-Semites. And I want to promote anti-Semitism, this is a great help in doing that, and I'll be referring to it more in the future. I've only got a few seconds left, so I want to thank you all for being here, and I will be posting this this speech tomorrow, so we'll add it to the collection of all the good material we have. See you again. Tune in Thursday night for our International Jew Study Hour at 7 p.m. Central Time. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.